Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're looking back to look forward. Speaking of a guy who doesn't look forward very much, Martin, me and you, we try not to look beyond the the next few hours when it comes to our relationship at this stage. You know,
yeah, I'd say half of Ireland is living like that in lockdown at the moment. One chap was on the other day, and he said, my wife has asked me to look at my our wedding video. What should I do? And I just went, smile politely. It's going to be a long time.
Yeah. I'm hearing reports of huge, huge people saying, like in Spain and Italy, after they're saying the divorce is going to be very high at the end of this. I'm just hoping you will put in to be emancipated, and I don't have to put up with you. listen, folks. This is a difficult time for everybody. I know that, but we do have to put the shout out for the patrons, and we're going to go even a bit broader on it this time. We're delighted to be joined via Zoom by Irish History Podcast host and fellow podcast alumni and actual podcast royalty. But so Finn, you're patreon.com/ Irish History, is it?
That's it, yeah.
Lads, you know, spread the love. No, honestly, Finn does brilliant stuff. He really does. I'm a long-time listener, a big admirer. But thanks so much for joining us. How are you keeping?
Good. Thanks a million for having me on again. I appreciate it. It's always great. There's no point, I think, at the moment of saying this is easy. It's not. You have your ups and downs, all the rest of it. It is hard not meeting people, not socializing, our whole life routine, even the very basics, like things of my working day. I always used to go to a cafe, and then suddenly I can't do that. And it seems like a small thing, but when you can't do it for 2 weeks, then you actually start going, wow, that small little bit of human interaction that broke up my day.
Yeah.
Because I work alone, actually meant a huge amount to me. But look, that's a minor thing in the grand scheme of things, isn't it? And I think maybe I'm lucky a bit in what I work at, in that get a sense maybe sometimes of the longer picture, and like having seen, you know, that we have been through this and we are going through this, but the people have been through this before, and there is, what we're going through is relatively short, hopefully, like, you know, as in it may be months and months, but it's not something that people haven't been through of one kind or another before. Maybe people in living memory haven't been through it, but humans have.
Well, the big one that people keep pulling on, and we spoke to Will Holden, who is he does crisis management and logistics, about emergency logistics team, and he was, you know, in Yemen during the cholera outbreak and things like that, and he spoke about the fact that, yeah, okay, this is unique in our life, in our lifetimes, but it's not without precedent, as you say. So the big one people keep going back to is the Spanish flu of 1918. Do you want to just give us, I know you've been talking about it for your own podcast and things like that at the moment, but
yeah, it's funny. I interviewed someone this morning, the historian John Dorney, actually, and we were talking, John has just written an article about numerous different kind of epidemics and pandemics in Irish history, and it's funny. I think everyone is trying to get their heads around this. Like, yeah, like we've been through it in terms of the flu pandemic at the end of the First World War, and there you're talking about, I think it was several million, 2 million people maybe died in Europe, 40, 50 million overall, and there was a huge public health emergency in that situation as well. I do think, in terms of historical analogies, though, there are other events, and like, you know, people always talk about war, and I do think, you know, you can look to a certain extent about for historical analogies of what people are going through as well in terms of wars. And I suppose, in terms of when this ends, I do think the analogies of wars probably comes more into its own, obviously, in terms of the fight at the moment, it's of a very different nature. But I think in terms of history, I think one of the most important things that people need to remember is that people make history. We have this sense that it's a juggernaut coming towards us, and maybe particularly at the moment, in the face of this pandemic, we're facing what we see as these things that we have no control over, a disease that only a small number of epidemiologists in the world really understand, that individuals have no control at all over. already we've seen that's not the case, because you can see wildly different approaches with different results, as well as in North Korea. South Korea's approach versus, say, the US, the UK, and then Ireland being somewhere, you know, on a slightly different trajectory. But that's all happening because of human decisions. And it's on a, I suppose, a macro level, governments taking decisions, and then down to every day, us doing things like social distancing, washing our hands 10, 15, 20 times a day. All the, like, we are, so my point is that this is as a result of human decision. So we're not totally powerless in this. And I think that is going to become the really important thing when this all ends, because I think there's a big question about the type of society we're going to live in, because there is a certain degree of truth that, like in all of these major moments, and that's kind of why I mentioned war, because I do think the analogy of war is that things, I do think there's probably sizable changes going to come about in our society as a result of this, and it's going to be quite difficult to go back.
I think, too, that, you know, there's a lot of things will have to be rethought. I mean, the very idea of, we've been gravitating towards cities for about the best part of 100 years. Are we going to start gravitating away from cities again now? These bigger questions, you know, that rural, it's better to be in a rural community during an outbreak than it is to be in a city during an outbreak. So I can see all these huge, big questions coming down the tracks at us. And we have to be prepared forevermore. This is not the shot across the bows. This is the actual deal. So from here on in, even if they get this one under control relatively quickly, well, then we have to be prepared forevermore to deal with it quickly and efficiently.
I would look at that, Martin, and I would honestly think that when you think about systems, will they automatically build those fail-safes into them? I don't know. But I think people will try to do that. And I think
I go with what Finn says with people. You know, that we've seen exoduses from cities over years, like the wealthy moved from the city centre in Dublin out to the burbs, and then the burbs became the city and they moved out further. So I think you might see that again after this, that those can afford to isolate physically into a more rural setting might just do it.
I think the initial phase, I think predicting maybe the longer term stuff is very, very difficult. Because there is, like, the logical thing, I think, in terms of what you're saying, Martin, is that there could be that thing of, like, people wanting to escape from the intensity of a city. And I suppose you saw certainly rumours that wealthy Irish people had to fled Ireland, actually, and some of them had gone. Do you remember the very early stage of the pandemic? There was kind of rumours in the press about that. But I think what is certainly is going to be is what happens in the 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, in terms of things like, I think there's going to be two paths that we have in terms of, we've seen the health service nationalized in the space for a week or two weeks. We've seen the government take decisions regarding housing, healthcare, all these things that we were all told were not possible, not legal, and were pipe dreams. That's all happened really quickly now. And I guess the powers that be are going to want things to go back when this, you know, be it 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. They want to reverse that and turn the clock back. And I think there's going to be also questions about where, like, we have spent. There's no question. Like, the country spent an enormous amount of money in the space of 4 weeks. I think it's up at 8.3 billion or something. And how we fund all this. And I think this is where history, I think, comes. There's great analogies here. Because, say, for example, at the end of the Second World War, and I think we always forget because we're looking at it from 78 years on. At the end of the Second World War, say, for example, Britain had emerged on the victorious side of that war. Contrary to their own propaganda, they hadn't really won it. The US and the Soviet Union had done most of the fighting and funding of the war. But the Britain was on the victorious side, had done fighting, could emerge with a lot of pride, but they were financially broke. That is the and it was very clear British society could never go back. The empire was done. Now, under the kind of the current way we have lived our lives over the last 20 years, the logic then would be austerity, austerity. Britain after the Second World War was very different. They had an election, Labour got in on a relatively radical manifesto that you saw things like the NHS set up and this huge programme. And I think you could see after this that people will have gone through a lot. And when we essentially win this, because we will win this, and I'm not saying it's not going to be really difficult, and there's a lot of people right now going through horrific situations in hospitals, in terms of healthcare workers and people suffering with corona. But at the end of this, us as a society are going to win this and we're going to come out of it. But then the question is what happens next? And I think that's where history provides us, because you can look at other examples in history where it doesn't go that way. In the, say, for example, in the 20s, or sorry, after the First World War, it doesn't go that way. And you have very different outcomes. But I think that is the thing. Maybe rather than the pandemics specifically on their own, I do think we're heading into that moment where such huge change has happened, like during the Second World War, where the economies were transformed really radically to fulfill the demands, in that case, of a war economy. We have gone through. Sorry.
No, just I think that's a great point. And I also think in that puzzle, though, the piece that's missing from that puzzle is, you know, OK, Britain was on its knees, absolutely on its knees financially. And the US delivered their, am I right in saying the Marshall Plan was the deal that was done? And it was, you know, people say, you know, they look at this the US also wasn't stupid. They knew if they were going to be producing industry and stuff, they needed markets to sell things into. And, you know, you needed a glow. This was the new world. So the also on the likes of what people can do, I think people will not be able to unsee one single tier health systems, not be able to unsee childcare that's taken care of by the state, and, you know, a ban on evictions and rent freezes that are possible. Although I do think rents are just going to fall anyway, given the likelihood of how we're going. But it also, the US stepped up then. It's going to be really, I keep saying it, I think it's on the EU to step up this time to show that, you know, as we say, when the bill falls due, and we keep hearing that there's going to be a bill for this, that it won't fall on the shoulders of people like us here who are sitting around self-isolating and looking and trying to do everything we are, and then possibly mourning people who we've, you know, family members and near family members. Because I think the alternative to that is the second path that this could go down, and then you end up with more a deepening of polarization and a deepening of distrust, and some of this the rise of nationalism that we've seen in certain areas for a few years. And, you know, I'm more optimistic. I genuinely think we can go the second road. I just think we need the EU to come with us.
I think there is two things, actually. There's one is our will ourselves to do this. And then there is, in any historical situation, you are naturally confined. Like, while we can say the individual has huge control, and they do have more control generally than we are often led to believe, obviously we're constrained by the wider situation we live in. And obviously, what you're raising there is, where is the overall financial aid going to come from? And, you know, Ireland is, if the will is in Ireland, and I would be really, that's one of the fears I have at the moment, where we're talking about a Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil coalition. Mm. Aside from whether they would even be willing to do it, I always think, or I question the lack of, whether they even have the imagination to bring in something like a welfare state of any kind. And that's I try and move away from kind of moral judgments on these things. I just think that's the way, you know, they look at those things in a certain way. And I think you would need someone in there pushing hard, going, this is actually possible. Because I don't think, particularly in the case of Fine Gael, they just see the world working in a different way. That said, if they feel the pressure on the outside, for example, we saw it in this situation with when the coronavirus came along. They knew they had to, because if they didn't, it just wasn't feasible not to. Now, people can create that dynamic themselves. And I guess that's what's an important thing to remember. If we go back to the analogy that I mentioned previously, like, there's no doubt the fact that you had hundreds of thousands of working class men returning back to Britain who knew how to use arms.
Yes, yes.
That had an influence on whether state was...
It did, because they had to build houses for these demobbed men, these men who knew how to organize and drill and shoot. I mean, they're not the type of people you want to leave standing around on street corners with one hand as long as the other. You want to give them something to do. I think after this that we haven't even gone to think of the radical changes that are possible, maybe probable. I definitely think that if it's a protracted period, a year, 18 months, that the politics that exist at the moment could be radically changed. There may not be a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael in the sense of those old parties. It didn't happen after World War One or after World War Two. Political systems did radically change. I have a feeling, back to your analogy about the war, is that this the banking collapse was World War One. Nothing changed afterwards. And now this is World War Two, where things did radically change afterwards because they couldn't leave them the same as they were after World War One, or else you'd have the same situation again.
Well, I think we can see a bit of what we're talking about in terms of commentary in the press, whereas last time around, to go back to what you were saying there, Martin, in terms of the banking crisis in 2008, during that, like, there was just a constant narrative coming from the press that austerity was a fact of life, and that if actually anyone was questioning austerity, they were, like, there was something wrong with them. Whereas now you can already see, like, you know, quite frequently on RTE, people questioning, going, is it even possible to go back to austerity? Now, I think people are going to push that narrative. They might call it, God knows what they'll call it. It won't be called austerity, but it'll be austerity by another name. Mm. Does it have to be like that? No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all, because I think there will be people in this country and all across Europe who come from, like, people who are by no means revolutionary or even might not even be progressive, but they will realize there's a balance in society, and to push that balance too far as a kilter leads, like you're saying, Martin, into dangerous territory. And to get European economies going again, they are going to have to look at the nature of. I think there is other stuff as well, actually, just while we're on it. I think I would hope out of this that there is a couple of things as well that I was only thinking about this. I was having a conversation with somebody else where we were just kind of throwing this back and forth. And I do think in terms of there could be some positives. And I know this is very early to be talking about this when people are going through, you know, people are going to lose loved ones in the coming weeks. And, you know, like I would just preface all that, like, in terms of very cognizant of that. But I do think that I would hope out of this, like, say, the anti-academia, anti-science stuff that we've seen being pushed by the alt-right and the right in general, that's going to now be really questioned, because that kind of stuff has led. You can see, for example, largely Ireland has adopted a science-based approach in terms of the reactions we have taken on the whole are led by that. You can, you know, argue whether it should have happened faster or slower or whatever, but generally, you look at the US, though, where there's that tension between those two, the science-based approach and who knows what. Like, you see those videos of people going, Jesus's blood is on me and I'm protected. And it's like, that's not, you're actually going to die now and you're going to kill other people. And I think, I would hope that out of this, those people are always going to believe that, those individuals. But the people around them who maybe previously would have gone down that road are going to go, no, I actually lived through a pandemic where vaccines, hopefully in a year's time, will have saved our lives and helped us return to normal. And I hope that will. And then secondly, just one other thing, sorry, I know I'm ranting on here. This hopefully will expose the conditions that people in direct provision are living in.
Yep.
Because I think the story is starting to come out now where you see, like, a bloody, like, kind of a division in a room of eight people, and that's supposed to be where someone is isolating. Like, you know, and I think what one thing that this coronavirus has shown is we all live in a society. You can't just put people away and pretend they don't exist and they don't affect the rest of us. We all live here together. And it's like, it doesn't matter whether you arrived last month, last week, or you were here 10 generations. There's only so many of us alive right now. And that's all that really matters.
As Mary McAuliffe put it, you know, Ireland has traditionally warehoused the poor. And the poor that they have warehoused now are those who are in most difficulty. Warehousing the poor is bad policy. It just is. It's not that that's new to us, that it's bad policy, but now we know it's really, really bad policy, and it's bad for people's health. And if it's bad for their health, it's bad for everybody's health. And that's the difference. It's not just kids in homeless kids who are now going to suffer psychological trauma from living in B&Bs. It's the whole of society is suffering psychological trauma because people were in conditions that weren't suitable.
There are really much more. I've spoken to Fergus Finlay and the guys and who've commissioned reports into these, and there's life-limiting experiences that, you know, that people have, direct provision, emergency accommodation, going through homelessness, and how it affects you in terms of life expectancy. Now, add a pandemic into that, and Finn, you're quite right to point out, it actually just shows that, to me, that the for-profit model, because direct provision became a for-profit business in effect, that has to go away. It has to be, when we see policies like things, when we say in Ireland we have a housing first policy, it is nothing like how housing policy works in the Nordic countries. You know, housing first, it means in the Nordics that you get your own front door and away you go. Only in the last few days have we seen where people who have been rough sleeping and when they're told they got a bed, for the last few years when they got a bed, that bed was often a yoga mat in Merchants Quay. Now they're getting, because of availability, they're getting a front door, and these things are changing.
Yeah. I think actually just what you're talking about there, Tony, of everything we're talking about, like how we're coping, the issue of how homelessness has been solved, inverted commas, but like, it's actually one of the things that has annoyed me most in all this, that like, we just basically have admitted that we value tourists who are coming here for a weekend, but actually not even a week. Most of these say Airbnbs could be a weekend. Mm. But we have more value on those people, than our friends, our neighbors, our family who have fallen on bad times. And if you want an indictment of a society, if that happened actually in, say, we always rail on about the 19th century and Victorian values and things like workhouses and how they treat the poor and the institutionalization of the poor in workhouses and talking about inmates and appalling. Sometimes you look at that and you go, how different are we? We've got, like, we codify it in different ways. Hmm. But like, if that happened in the 19th century, you would look at it and go, like, what kind of monsters are these people that they allowed 10,000 people go homeless, and then just when it became profitable, as you say, to allow them back into the houses, they did. I know it's odd. It's not something I didn't know in terms of, but like when you see it solved that quick, because when you're told week in, week out, going, this is an extremely complex problem to solve, it cannot be done immediately, and then suddenly it's done because no one wants to come to Ireland anymore, or tourists can't come to Ireland anymore. And it's solved. And I think that for me was one of the things that made me angriest, just in terms of, because it's one really tangible thing. And it's like, it took a pandemic to sort a problem that's very sortable. And hopefully it won't go back. And maybe, you know, we need to take a long, hard look at many things after this, but the tourist industry is definitely one of them. And the way the tourist industry relates to the people who live in this country. And that said, as someone who is actually reliant on the tourist
industry. Yeah, and I was just going to say that you yourself are reliant on the tourist industry. But, you know, you say I think we as an electorate have allowed it, but individually, an awful lot of people have stood up over the years and said, no, we can't allow this. But the voice of profit sort of shouted down those voices. And we saw it literally. And it wasn't government intervention that brought Airbnb down. It wasn't. No, it was simply nobody can travel, or nobody was stupid enough to say, I'm going to sleep in somebody else's bed. I think those days are gone for a long time, actually. Until you're global free, are you going to be traveling? The globetrotting days could be a long way away.
I was talking to someone about this, a pal of mine there over the weekend, and we were kind of debating, will it ever come back? Like, you know, because there's two things I think that need for that to happen. So one is like that, say there's a vaccine brought in, and saying, just say, for example, in 3 years' time, they've got this fail-safe vaccine for coronavirus, you're not going to catch us, and there's no other pandemics. Then our behavior also has to change. And I wonder, will people want to go to places where they don't understand the health system? Even if the health system works fine, they're just going to, yeah, but if I'm there and this happens. And, you know, we all have the memories of things like the cruise ships or people being trapped in airports, being asked for 20 grand to get back. I would wonder, like, you know, maybe it'll just be more regional. So maybe, like, you know, we might go, maybe the idea of going for a caravan in the Isle of Man might be the new, like, it might come back, like, you know.
I got Betty's Town for 2 weeks. How dare you?
But I do think your analogy of a war is one that we should keep coming back to.
And I'd stay away from it.
No. I think on a global scale, we have to treat it that way, that the idea that you just put a lid on it and let it burn slowly is maybe not the best idea for a small country that could close its borders and literally stop it in its tracks. So the idea of letting it burn through a small country, I'm not too keen on that idea. I think you have to take it back village by village, town by town, county by county, country by country, region by region. And I think Europe, if it got its act together, probably has a better chance of having travel within Europe, you know, be able to travel within a free zone, if you know what I mean, to have a free zone that can trade and travel. And I think that ultimately should be the goal, to get everything back up again.
Yeah. I would say I think it's incumbent on Europe and the West, given the vast resource of money we have, to help, like, what exactly is going to happen in Africa is obviously a huge debate, because we haven't seen the full impact. And, like, obviously I think there is a tendency to run down African countries and kind of like talk about this. Like, it was great. I followed this journalist from South Africa on Twitter, and she was making the point that, like, someone went, the mystery of why some country, I can't remember what country in Africa it was, hadn't this really high epidemic rate. And she's going, there's no mystery. They've just dealt with pandemics before, so they're actually a bit more further out of track than, say, Ireland would be. But, sorry, my point is, though, is that I do think we need to look at this. Well, I agree with you on one level, Martin. You obviously, locally, regionally, this has to be solved on a global level, because otherwise we'll never be able to open, like, Europe up again beyond that. And that needs to happen too. And how we, so there, and there are going to be parts of the world that are going to need serious help, probably financial help in doing this.
Just on, like, again, I know I'm like a broken record, because I go back to my favorite writers and all the rest of it all the time, and pass off their knowledge as if I knew it myself. But nonetheless, you know, I always talk about the lifestyle wars that were fought out there so we could have a certain standard of living here, you know, and we talk about that. And there is going to be an onus now, as you say, that will fall on the West to step up and say, you know, when we start to push this thing back, that we do step up, because it needs to change. If it was susceptible, a pandemic can start anywhere. I know people have seen nonsense about the Brits saying China owes us $300 billion for this, you know.
We might join that queue here, actually, you know. Like,
reparations, you say?
Chinese might just come back and go, yeah, when you pay us reparations for, like, fighting two wars in the 19th century to force opium into the country. But anyway.
Why didn't you open up to the opiate war, or more like, look, we could just go on and on and on for all day. But I do think that you know, it shows that the globalization is what's different between now and 1918. The world is a lot smaller. You know, it's like all of those trade deals, all of those, you know, I can get my Colombian coffee, I can, you know, I can do all of those things, and we're all connected a lot more than we ever were. And that won't go away. It will just change. And I do think the onus then will be on the West to step up. And I'd love to think that, I've said this isn't the death of capitalism. I've said it is the death of neoliberal capitalism. And that would be a huge victory. And it's often in historic terms, it's often the second shock to the system that kills it, you know. And the first one was, this is so soon after the last one in terms of the global financial crisis, and now this pandemic. And this pandemic has ripped through the world a lot quicker than the contagion of Lehman Brothers and Bear State, you know, and everything else that happened. So it's a different thing altogether. Finn, last question for me, for you. In terms of the choices that people make and how you, in terms of what you've seen in terms of history, just to give people an idea, when you say we're not powerless, can you think of other situations where it's been the people who have then stood up afterwards?
To be honest, actually, Tony, I know this doesn't answer your question in a way, but I think you can flip it the other way. It's like, when has history changed by the power of an individual? Like, it just doesn't really, like, we tell history in the story of individuals because that's an easy way, and it's the way I think our brains understand it. Now, that's not to say that individual people don't play roles. Of course they do. I'm not denying that. That would just be nonsense to say that there isn't key moments that happen. But it's like the idea that there's this like destined individual somewhere out there right now, and that person has to act for us to be saved is nonsense, or they're going to dictate the future of Ireland is nonsense. These individuals act within society and act in relation to how everyone else acts. And I think it's often wheeled out, a small example, what Dunstore's workers did in Ireland in the 1980s in terms of having this huge global impact in terms of South Africa. You can look back, though, at, like, I'm trying to like think of an example where you can go, that is not the case, because I firmly believe that, like, often where the quote-unquote great man comes in, it's often where a lot of the change has already happened by ordinary people, and they're the one that rides in on top of it. And I think particularly what we're talking about, the next stage here, that's not going to happen. That's going to be about things like we've seen, say, in terms of the water tax. The water tax is a classic example of where it took hundreds of thousands of Irish people, ordinary people, all doing individual things. There was no key person there that was involved in that you can look at and go, if they weren't involved in it, it wouldn't be the same. It's all down, and that's what we're heading into again, is that, like, all of us need to go out there, and what form this is going to take, I have no idea. Like, that's all dictated by, that is to a certain degree outside our control. Are these conflicts coming? Generally, I just can't see how we're not going to end up in a huge debate about the future of society. The people who have control now are unlikely to be willing to accept that change, and there's going to end up being some tension around that. And I think that's where this is headed. But can we win? And when I say we, I didn't mean ordinary people, and people end up in a better place. Definitely hard questions, how all this is going to be funded, all the rest of it. But we've never been in a better position, in that things that we have been told for over a generation were impossible are clearly possible now, and actually relatively easily. What's happened here is that, like, you've almost seen, like, you know, it's kind of like we're having this bizarre experiment in socialism. Like, you know,
I also think there seems to be a driving force or a yen for that strong man character in pretty much every country, including our own, you know, making heroes of people. And I think it's unfair to do that to the people themselves in the first place. It puts them on a pedestal that's very easily knocked down when things don't go so well. I also think that it leaves out the much wider narrative of broader society. You know, we'll all unite behind Churchill, or we'll all unite behind Boris Johnson. And it doesn't...
That's so depressing. We'll all unite behind Boris Johnson.
But I mean it sincerely. Like,
I know what you mean. Yeah, I just find
the Americans think... There's enough Americans who think Trump walks on water, so that he's America's strong man. There's enough Russians who think that Putin walks on water, and there's enough Irish people who think that Farage walks on water. So, but, you know, it's not fair to those people in the first place to put them on those pedestals, because they will eventually get knocked off them. I also think that it's not listening to a much broader narrative that exists.
I'll just come in and say, do forget that World War II didn't end until Winston Churchill beat Hitler in an arm wrestle.
Finn, how is your health keeping, buddy?
Yeah, good.
Can I come in here? The two lads can compare. Who was sick? Who was sick more recently? No, I don't. We're gonna wrap up now, but I do want to say it's patreon.com/Irish History. Yeah. Check out Finn's pods, guys. Support people through these difficult times. And I want to give a shout out to one of our members, Maura O'Toole, who is one of our Patreon supporters. And the reason I'm doing that is because at the moment, as you know, we don't have much good to go out. So we might as well shout out to people who chip in and help us every month. So thanks very much, Maura. I hope you all enjoyed that. We will talk to you all soon. Thank you.